The show you have selected will start directly after the next message.
Welcome to the future you. Frank Lloyd Wright once said, "Study nature, love nature, stay close to nature, and it will never fail you." At Zija, we love nature. We study nature. In India, we discovered Moringa and created Moringa Supermix, a revolutionary new combination of organic ingredients, including natural vitamins, minerals, proteins, antioxidants, and omega oils. Zija's new Moringa Supermix will help you make a change for the better. Simply click on the Zija banner on the UKHealthRadio.com homepage. Power people need power vitality.
Hello, nice to have you join me for another Yes to Life show. If you're new to the show, I'm Robin Daly, founder of the UK charity Yes to Life, that helps people with cancer to find out about and access integrative medicine. Having said that, at this point, the first shoots of integrative medicine are only just beginning to show in the UK. And if you want the full benefit to be had from integrating a wide range of approaches from complementary and alternative medicine with conventional methods, then the first port of call is Germany. In today's show, I shall be speaking with a German practitioner of integrative medicine, Dr. Reinhard Probst, about the range of methods he offers and why. I'm speaking to Dr. Probst over the phone in Munich. Good morning, Reinhard. Thanks very much indeed for coming on the show. Tell us about your work in Germany.
Hi, Robin. Thank you for having me on your show.
Great. All right. One of the most striking facts that emerged from the talk that I heard you give in Bristol just recently is the fact that whereas you would primarily think of yourself as a naturopath and a homeopath and various other disciplines you practice, and you describe yourself as specializing in biological cancer therapy, actually you use chemotherapy as well. So why?
So I would consider me as a physician who likes to treat people, to help patients, and therefore I don't use this kind of labels anymore. When I started medicine, I actually started with homeopathy, which I found extremely intriguing, curing people by giving them only three or four pills. But then I worked in a hospital for naturopathy, and we were connected to the University of Munich, and we had a lot of specialists that came to our hospital with different methods like acupuncture, neurotherapy, chiropractic, and so on. And I learned quickly that that is not only one way of treating people. So there are different ways.
Mm-hmm.
So the contact with cancer was actually when a dear friend of mine got ill. She had breast cancer with liver metastasis.
Mm-hmm.
And I really tried everything to help her, but unfortunately I failed and eventually she died. So I learned a lot of this case.
And this kind of convinced you that you wanted to do more to help people with cancer?
Yeah, it was. I opened my practice and then I was still connected to the university and they sent me a lot of cancer patients. So first I tried to do it in a complementary way, so like additional to school medicine to reduce side effects, for example, to boost the immune system, to acupuncture against nausea, for example. But then I had more and more patients with progressed stages of cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And so I found out that school medicine couldn't really help them. That normally they produce a lot of side effects and but cannot really prolong the life of the patient. So I tried to find other methods of helping them.
Excellent, yeah. You describe yourself as specializing in biological cancer therapy, but you use chemotherapy as well. Now, in the UK, this would be unthinkable due to the restrictions we work under here. The people who practice chemotherapy are not interested in biological approaches, and the people who practice biological approaches are not allowed to administer chemotherapy. So you're in a very different scenario in Germany. Do you want to tell us a bit about the environment you work in?
It's the lesson of the Nazi regime. The Nazi regime forced physicians to treat in a special way or to do cruel things. And therefore, after World War II, it's now in our constitutional law that therapy is free. We have freedom of therapy. Of course, we have health and safety regulations, and there are lists with forbidden substances, but the right to treat a patient in the best way, I think, I'm responsible for the patient, is always possible in Germany. So at least still now. I mean, there are, of course, forces that want to change everything, but now I can use both. And for me, there are only substances. There are biological substances, there are chemo agents, but the main focus are these are substances. And if you, for example, watch the cyclophosphamide would be a chemo agent, and in high dosages it's extremely dangerous, poisonous, but in low doses it actually helps the immune system. It has a strong anti-inflammatory effect. So in that way it would be used as a biological substance, in my understanding. But the most substance I use, more than, I would say, 95% are natural biological substances derived from plants.
Okay, well, look, that's what I want to look at now. I'm interested to talk more about the chemotherapy, but we can do that later. Just tell us about your main natural approaches that you use? What's the number one thing that you rely on?
It always depends on the cancer and on the cancer cells. What we actually do is a sensitivity test to find out what would the best substance or the best substances to use on that special type of cancer. But so one of my number ones really is curcumin. It's derived from the turmeric plant. And this is a very intelligent substance because the curcumin interacts with more than 100 metabolic pathways in the cancer cell.
Wow.
So if you compare it to a normal chemo agent, it only attacks one single spot. And this sometimes, of course, has a really strong effect. It's like, if you compare it to a big city, if you block the main street,
right,
so it can paralyze the city. But very soon, there are bypasses, and so is it with cancer cells. So they become resistant very soon. So the curcumin is a much more intelligent substance, and therefore it's actually the main important substance I use.
Now, you're using it in an unusual way, though. You're not just giving people capsules of curcumin, as would have been done up until recently. You're actually using it intravenously, I understand. Do you want to say a bit about that?
The reason why I give it as infusion is that is a fatty soluble substance, and it's really difficult to get it through the bowels. Therefore, administering of infusion is the better way. You have it directly in the bloodstream, and from the bloodstream it goes directly into the tissues. So if you take it orally, it's extremely difficult to reach a certain level in the tissue. But for preventing cancer, of course you can take it orally or with nutrition. But if you have a growing cancer, an actual cancer, problem, the infusion would be much better.
Hmm. So as with most natural approaches, what is good practice as prevention needs to be ramped up if you've actually got cancer.
Yeah, if you want to prevent something, you can do it with nutrition. So I would prefer turmeric as a spice.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm actually confronted with a lot of progressed stages of cancer, with actually growing cancers. And so we have to find something that works really quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And you cannot wait for months or years to have an effect.
No, that's true. There's you have a kind of emergency situation to deal with, to dampen down the fire, yes, so to speak. Yeah. Okay, other natural substances that you use?
Very interesting substance is amygdalin.
Mm-hmm.
Amygdalin, it actually was the first substance I saw a really strong effect on metastasized cancer. So I tried vitamin C before, but the effect was more or less poor. But the amygdalin was the first substance I could really, I have to say, cure a cancer patient. With colon cancer with liver metastasis, it disappeared completely.
Wow, good.
And the patient is still healthy.
Mm.
But unfortunately, though, I tried then a lot of amygdalin therapies. I'm in high frequent settings, in high dosages, but unfortunately with normally poor results.
Mm.
So this is a substance that is very important for me, but you have to combine it with other substances, in my view.
Mm-hmm. So just to be clear, this has got various names. People may know it by other names as well. This is also known as Laetril or vitamin B17.
Yes.
And again, we're in a different situation. No doctor is allowed to administer it in Britain. You can buy it. It's not a banned substance, and you can use it yourself.
Mm-hmm.
But no doctor's allowed to administer it. Well, it's interesting what you say. I mean, obviously, after years of being big news in various places like Mexico, way back in the 60s and 70s, it seems to have settled down to being seen as a useful substance, basically, in amongst other things. It's not that it's useless. It definitely seems to have an effect, but it's got its limitations.
Yes.
Apart from occasionally, as you described, we have a miracle cure with it, but that's not generally the rule, is it?
Yes. The problem with the vitamin B7 and amygdalin is that it's claimed to be toxic.
Yes.
That is toxic and has no real effect on cancer cell. But the history of amygdalin was that it was used in the United States until 1970. I think more than 80,000 patients got that substance without any side effects, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was the famous war on cancer from Nixon. And they tested 100 or 1,000 of substances in the laboratory, and they found out that amygdalin was the only substance that could prevent cancer to spread metastasis. So it was extremely interesting substances.
Mm.
So they decided to do a study with patients, with actual patients, and then there was 2 years silence. And then the FDA forbade the amygdalin. And why is that? I think it was because it's too cheap and it's a natural substance.
Mm.
And then it was forbidden in the United States and then in Europe, in Germany as well. But we had a pharmacy here in Germany. They produced the amygdalin, And they sued against this prohibition. And they won the process.
Oh, really? Right. Okay. Where, how long ago was that?
It was, I think, 15 years ago.
Right. Okay. Interesting.
And I read the verdict, and then I found out, okay, that amygdalin is a non-toxic substance. So, and then I actually dared to use it. Before I thought, okay, it's toxic and non-effective, why should I use it? I would have been mad to use it, but then I thought, okay, it's non-toxic. And then we had a research from the University of Frankfurt. They made a cell research, and they actually found out that it has a strong effect on cancer cells. And then we did a little research in my practice, because I had a lot of amygdalin patients where I used amygdalin in these days. And we checked the blood if it's poisonous, if there are a lot of hydrogen cyanide in the bloodstream, and there is nothing. You have no toxic effect of the amygdalin. And I think I made more than 6,000, 7,000 amygdalin infusions without any side effects.
So, yeah, the claims around its toxicity were due to the fact that it has a kind of cyanide byproduct which does the work, but it doesn't necessarily poison the patient, does it?
It's a theory. You have the amygdalin consists of two molecules, glucose and benzaldehyde, and one nitrile group, and this group is split apart by an enzyme that is called beta-glucosidase.
Yeah.
And the beta-glucosidase is produced by tumor cells. This is actually true. And so the theory is the nitrile group is split apart and it becomes hydrogen cyanide, and this is toxic for the tumor cells. But actually, it's like this: the cyanide blocks the respiratory energy cycle, but normally the cancer cells don't use the respiratory energy cycle; they use the fermentation process.
Right.
So I'm not that convinced that this might be the effect of amygdalin and the University of Frankfurt found, for example, that is an mTOR blocker. And mTOR is a very important protein in the cancer cell who drives the tumor growth. So maybe it's more or less this way how amygdalin acts.
Right. Okay. So it could be entirely wrong. And in terms of administering amygdalin, again, are you doing it intravenously?
Yeah, I do it intravenously. I normally combine it with dichloroacetate. Because dichloroacetate blocks the fermentation process. So if that is true, that amygdalin blocks the respiratory energy cycle, I mean, it's the end of the metabolic pathway of the glucose degradation, then there is the fermentation process left. So we block both. We block the respiratory energy cycle, the fermentation process, and then in theory the cancer cells cannot use glucose anymore. But they need glucose. I mean, they feed only on glucose, not on fat.
So you just mentioned DCA there. That sort of burst onto the market a few years ago. It was big news on the internet with people using it themselves. So you again find that a useful substance for a particular approach. So it's part of an approach.
It's a possible approach, but again, this is no miracle substance, unfortunately. And it was actually the first substance I saw side effects, because if you give it in higher dosages, it can lead to neurotoxic symptoms. Like trembling, shaking, like dizziness. So I only administered as an infusion. There are normally, I experience no side effects at all. And I normally always combine it with amygdalin in the same bottle.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is safe, but if you take it orally, so you can see a lot of side effects.
Right, okay. And you also mentioned as you went along vitamin C, which you've used. How, again, do you use this intravenously or a liposomal? And again, what? How do you find it in terms of its usefulness?
So vitamin C is a very interesting substance because it's a very simple substance. It goes easily into cancer cells. And then it depends on the dosage. If you give it in a very low dosage, it has an antioxidative effect. So it wouldn't harm the cancer cells. But if you give it in a higher dosage, like over 20 or 30 grams as an infusion, it actually reacts with the cancer cell and peroxide and hydrogen peroxide. And hydrogen peroxide is a toxin, a cell toxin, and it poisons the cancer cells from the inside. So again, this is dosage dependent. And I used it a lot. And what I did was first measuring the number of circulating tumor cells. And then I gave, say, 10 or 15 vitamin C infusions. And then I measured the number again. And almost always it dropped more than I think 95% of the cases. So for prevention, for cancer patients, they had the tumor removed. It's a very important substance. If you have a growing cancer, the vitamin C alone is too weak in my experience.
Right, interesting. Okay. Are there any other natural substances you rely on generally?
I talk about the artesunate. Artesunate is a well-known substance in Chinese medicine. It was used against malaria.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, if school medicine found out that it's effective against malaria, and it's used in a semi-synthetic way, so it is used and it acts in the tumor cell in the same way as vitamin C, because it connects to the iron, and there is a radical produced. So it's also a very interesting and sometimes effective substance. One more substance that is an extremely important substance is the so-called Ishi-Chi, the green tea extract, because it actually can attack tumor stem cells, because that is the main problem with cancer, that tumor stem cells are dividing themselves very slowly, and you cannot attack them with chemotherapy or with radiotherapy. So there are sleeping cells. They sleep for many, many years, and then they can produce a relapse. And there is no known substance against these tumor stem cells, but EGCG from the green tea, and maybe resveratrol, but no chemo agent. Therefore, it's also a very important substance for me.
I can see that.
There is a very good oral product I use. It's called Tegovit.
And what is that?
So this is an oral product. It was found by a researcher. He had a certain disease, amyloidosis, so a protein disease, and he tested it on himself with different ways of preparation and found the best way. And therefore I use it a lot as infusions, but also as pills. Green tea extract can do a lot more. Green tea extract has an anti-inflammatory effect as well, and it can control myomes, for example. So I give it with my myome patients.
Right. So you use, you say you use testing in order to see the effect of the things you're doing. So this is what's given you the confidence you have in the substances that you use.
Yeah, the test is for doing, say, tailored therapy that I can find out what I can actually use on the patient. In school medicine, it's more or less a cookbook medicine. So you have a certain cancer, and then you look at page 13, and then you give three agents. Right. So, but we actually know that only 30% of the tumors are reacting to the chosen substances. And that is a very intelligent or very important idea to test it on the tumor cells. And because we have a lot of tumor cells swimming in the bloodstream, you can actually fishing them out. Good laboratories can that, and test substances on them. So it's a very important thing for me.
And so you're using the substances, as you said, in combination generally, but in a specific combination tailored to each patient.
Yes, because first I want to find out what's really effective in this patient. And then I think about it, how to combine it. For example, we spoke about artisanate and vitamin C. So the effect is very similar. So it's not a good idea to combine these two substances. So I try to choose substances that act in a very different way. Because cancer is a very difficult problem. You don't have only one single type of cells. You have different type of cells. They react differently. So it's, as I told you with the curcumin, it's more intelligent to attack cancer cells from different spots. And this is what I'm trying, what I try to do.
Right. Okay. So now I'd like to get on to the chemotherapy side. Now you're using something called insulin potentiated therapy, so IPT for short.
Yes.
Would you just tell us exactly what it is?
The idea is more than 80 years old. It was invented in Mexico. And insulin was a new substance. And so a Mexican doctor, Donato, experimented with this substance and thought it was like a miracle drug. But then chemotherapy came up and they combined it with chemotherapy. And they saw actually a better effect. But why was that? The theory is like this: cancer cells have a lot more insulin receptors than normal cells. And this is true, that's actually true, because cancer cells need more glucose, and insulin brings the glucose into the cells.
Okay.
This is the main factor or the main issue of insulin. But insulin has different effects. It makes the cell more penetrable, not only for sugar, but also for other substances. So the idea is giving insulin, but without sugar. So if you take it more simply, you make the cell hungry, and then you give chemo agent, but only a 20% dose in this time. So we give insulin intravenously. It connects to the receptor. We produce a little bit of low blood sugar. It's harmless for the patient. And then in this time, the tumor cell is extremely sensitive. And then we give only this low-dose chemotherapy, and normally the patients don't experience any side effects, but the tumor is shrinking. So I could prove it with a lot of patients.
Hmm. So would you say that you have, you're saying you give 20% of the dose. Do you have a
Yes.
comparable effect to giving 100% without the insulin?
If I gave a 100% dose, I have a lot of disadvantages because first thing I do is to destroy the immune system because immune cells are extremely sensitive to chemo agents. In earlier times, we thought, okay, the immune system cannot help against cancer. It doesn't recognize the cancer cells, but the opposite is true. The immune system recognizes the cancer cells and it's actually present in any type of cancer. And the more immune cells are within the cancer, the slower the cancer growth. So what happens very often if you give a chemotherapy in high dosages, that the cancer shrinks or goes away very quickly, and you have a beautiful photo in the CT scan or MRI. But then after 2 or 3 months, or sometimes these are only weeks, it starts growing more rapidly as before. Why? Because you destroyed the immune system. And this is the main difference between the IPT and the normal high dosage chemotherapy. So you have a lot of side effects, and normally you cannot prolong the life of the patients.
Okay, so it's not that the agent is necessarily having a lot more effect. It's more that it does it in a more effective way, which is preserves the patient's own health.
Yes, my aim is R2. We have two things to achieve. One, to prolong the life of the patient and to enhance life quality. I found that oncologists normally do it like this. We have to destroy the tumor cells. It has to go away completely with the chemotherapy. The side effects are not that important. The main thing is to destroy the tumor. But as I said, I mean, very quickly the tumor reappears. And that is the problem that we have with metastasized tumors.
So you would say that your interests, the targets you're working towards, are actually more in the interests of the patient.
I would say that, yes, because life quality is a very important issue. If I see, for example, people with metastatic pancreatic tumors, they normally live only 6 months. During this period, they are really, I would say, tortured with chemo agents. They have extremely poor life quality, and the outcome is extremely poor as well. So why doing this? And for me, this approach is almost unethical.
Okay,
And if you
so.
compare it to my therapies, to my approach, so the life quality is extremely high and the outcome is, I would say, better. But of course, if I want to prove that, we had to do studies. But this costs, of course, money.
Okay, so we're getting on towards the end of our time. I just want to quickly ask you about resensitization, which is a bit of a buzzword at the moment, because as you say, the problem with most chemo approaches and all sort of single target therapies is that they have a limited life, they stop working. And there seems to be a potential amongst biologicals to actually turn that around and to resensitize tumors to treatment, which can be a lifesaver or a life extender for somebody who's at the last stages with very few options. Could you just say something about that quickly?
Yes, and this is the idea why I combine biological substances with chemo agents. So the chemo agents for a quicker response, for a quicker effect on brain tumors, and then to enhance the effect, to prolong the effect with biological agents. As I told you, curcumin, the tumor cell cannot become resistant against curcumin. It's too intelligent substance. But on the other hand, it normally works too slowly for to attacking a growing tumor. And another substance I use that is extremely interesting is methadone. Methadone can actually also overcome tumor resistance. It's a substance I use a lot with cancer patients.
Okay, so methadone is really only known associated with a drug problem, know, but you're saying it has a use here in therapy.
Yes, a researcher from Germany, Dr. Friesen, a friend of mine from the University of Ulm, found out if you give it in a cell culture, if you give, for example, a chemo agent to a certain tumor cell culture, you can destroy normally 30 or 40% of the cells. Mm-hmm. But if you add methadone to the culture, then you destroy almost 100%.
Wow.
This is extremely interesting because methadone leads, she found out that methadone leads that chemo agents can enter more easily the tumor cells. And then one, the most important mechanism for the resistance is the tumor cells pump the chemo agent out of the cell. So it goes in and the tumor cell pushes it out.
Yes.
And this is blocked by the methadone.
Right, I see.
And therefore, if I experience this, that I see, okay, the patient becomes resistant against my therapy, I'll always add methadone.
Okay. So another therapy that you use regularly, I understand, is hypothermia. So it's much more popular, as most things are in this area in Germany, than it is here in the UK. But I wanted to talk quickly about hypothermia. It's a big topic, and I've done a separate radio show with two hypothermia experts, Dr. Sahinbus and Professor Vayner.
Yes.
So I'll provide a link to that with this show. But I'd really like to hear from you. I mean, it also has this property of resensitizing tumors, I believe. I'd just like to hear about the ways you use it, the reasons you use it in combination with other treatments.
I use it as a regional hypothermia that acts like this. Between two electrodes, there is an electric field created and that heats up the tissue.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that cancer cells are extremely sensitive to heat because they cannot build so many heat shock proteins. If a normal cell is warmed up, they build like proteins on their surface to protect themselves.
Mm-hmm.
But tumor cells, and we can prove it also in the laboratory, have normally a lower degree of these heat shock proteins. So they're extremely sensitive. So we could say they are more or less naked against the heat. They're unprotected against the heat. This is one fact. Then you have a higher circulation. So if you give natural or chemo agents, you have more of these substances in the tissue. You're heating up. And then tumor cells are sensitive to the electric field. So we treat, for example, brain tumors with hypothermia. But of course, you cannot heat the brain too much up. You cannot cook the brain.
No.
We only use the electric field with very good results in combination. So I combine it a lot, and if of course I have patients, I only treat them in a complementary way. They use the normal dosage chemotherapy, and I try to support that with hypothermia then.
So hypothermia in those instances is just improving the activity of the standard therapy they're having.
It is. But there is another way of hypothermia that is very interesting. The active hypothermia is without a device. It's It's created with, for example, dead bacteria. It's a different way of treating patients with hypothermia, passive hypothermia with devices. You have a physical effect. You attack it through the heat with the active hypothermia, with the immune system. And this is also very helpful in my view. So, for example, in the next room, there is a patient. I gave her a small dose of bacteria, of dead bacteria in the morning. And now she has more than 40 degrees fever. And this is a different way. I mean, we don't attack the cancer with the heat, but with the immune system. The immune system becomes extremely active during the active fever therapy, and it's also very helpful.
So this is a sort of variation on colis toxins.
Yeah, this is colis. I use colis toxin, but I could talk about that in 1 hour. It's
right. Okay, but that was going to have to wait. But that would be a very interesting program, in fact. So look, I just want to round off by asking you about, if someone in the UK were to consider consulting you, what kind of arrangements do you have in place to support people who are coming over to Germany, both while they're having treatment and then as follow-up afterwards?
So normally patients come to my practice for the first interview. It takes 1 hour, and then we decide if we do the test on the circulating tumor cells, and then it takes 9 days. Then I get the test result, then I can make a puzzle. Normally the patient for this 1 day and then goes back to the UK, for example, and then we start after a fortnight with the therapies. And normally the patient come then go in a hotel close by, many hotels here in Munich. And they come normally every day. I treat them every day with different methods. We spoke about that. And then they go home. I put the tumor markers normally every week, and we quickly normally see the response of the patient. What I found out, if we do that in this very intense way, that sometimes it actually keeps tumor under control over a longer period. So, and sometimes I do it one time, and then it makes the patient sometimes stable for months or sometimes years. So, but of course, whatever you use to control the tumor growth has to be repeated. And if you have again tumor growth, of course you can add a new session of therapies. The advantage of the therapies is you can do it as often as possible. I mean, you can do with the IPT, it's harmless. You have normally no side effects. You can do it 10 times or you can do it 20 times.
I understand,
so,
right.
No problem with that.
Okay, and so if somebody came over to you for this first visit, they'd had their test done and everything, you'd then be in a position to say what kind of costs they would expect to have a treatment with you. Obviously, you couldn't say how long the effect was going to be for, but you would be able to give indications of what kind of cost.
Yes, normally the first visit costs 120 euros. Then if we do the test costs 2,000 euros, a bit expensive, but it's very important, because we have to do guesswork how we boost it. And then I get the test result and I can do an exact proposal, estimate of procedure I would go with the patient.
Right, I understand. Okay, that's great. Very helpful. I'm sure people want to sort of get a real-world idea of what they might be letting themselves in for. So we're going to have to end it there. Thank you very much. Like here in the UK, we can only kind of dream of practitioners being able to push the boundaries of treatment in the way that you can there in Germany. But thankfully, Germany is not too far away for us. So thanks very much for taking the time to talk to us today. It's really been very informative.
You're really welcome. You're really welcome, Robin.
The sound was a little broken up towards the end of the interview there, but I hope that didn't detract from what Dr. Probst was saying. There have always been forces at work to keep natural treatments out of the mainstream in the UK, and it's clear from talking to Dr. Probst that the regulatory framework we have supports the continuing treatment apartheid and inhibits the move towards integration. But pressure from you, the public, is growing rapidly, and ways will, in the end, have to be found to make integration possible. I'd like to let you know about two upcoming events in the Yes to Life calendar. Firstly, free help is at hand with the business of making a will or setting up powers of attorney at our event led by a specialist in this area in Camden, London on the 7th of March. And on the 21st of March, we have Let's Talk Cannabis at the Bloomsbury Gallery, London, led by a researcher and an expert in the law around cannabis. Full details of both events and booking can be found on the Yes to Life website, that's yestolife.org.uk, along with links to resources related to today's show. I hope you enjoyed the show and can join me again next week. Goodbye.